Two men from Central Illinois pleaded guilty in federal court in Minnesota last week for trying to bomb a mosque there in August of 2017. Here's Jelani Hussein speaking with Minnesota Public Radio.
They wanted to attack the Muslim community. They wanted for the Muslim community to fear, and they wanted the Muslim community to run away. Here today, we're here as a community. We're not going anywhere.
Also, the Illinois Supreme Court is hearing a case today that asks, how long is too long when it comes to sentencing juvenile offenders? And if you wind up with a cold or the flu, it's tempting to call your doctor for an antibiotic. But one new study shows more than 80% of the time when we're prescribed antibiotics, we don't actually need them. Up first, Illinois is facing sub-zero temperatures for the next couple of days. How do you decide whether or not to close school? We'll hear from a superintendent about what goes into that decision. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and I hope everyone is staying warm today. Don't worry, that's not all we're talking about this hour. We've got a very full hour of news for you, but we are starting with the weather as we gear up for back-to-back days here where even the air temperature without the wind chill is well below zero. Governor Pritzker has just issued a disaster proclamation for the state ahead of the Arctic weather that we're expecting tonight and tomorrow. And many schools across the state have already closed, like Bradley and Illinois State University. The University of Illinois also just announced that they are canceling classes starting this evening and through tomorrow. And we're hearing about lots of K-12 schools that will be closing. Keep a close ear to this NPR station for more information on your local school closings. When it comes to K-12 schools, superintendents are the ones who have to make that difficult decision. Whether or not the school is closed can have a huge impact on students, parents, and teachers. So how do superintendents make that call? We thought we'd check in with one to talk about it. On the line with me now is Carl Johnson, superintendent of the Kelowna School District near the Quad Cities, where it's currently 5 degrees, but could get as low as negative 27. That's the air temperature. That's before the wind chill tomorrow. Superintendent Johnson, thanks for taking the time to speak with us this morning. Good morning.
Well, thank you for the call, Nyla. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. I wonder how you're doing. And before we get to the conversation about how you make this decision, I wonder what our listeners throughout the state should know about your school district.
Well, Kelowna School District is a K-8 district. Our students, when they leave here, will attend United Township High School in East Moline, Illinois. And it is a township high school where I was actually principal for 7 years prior to coming here. So our students are trying to keep warm just like everybody else. We do not have rural areas, which I'll probably talk a little bit about today. We're basically contained within our small town, about 500 students here. So.
And is everyone in school today, it sounds like?
We are. However, attendance is not stellar today. I wouldn't lie to you and say that everybody arrived today. We probably are looking at about 20 to 25% absentee rate right now, and we're scheduled to get out at 1:30 today.
Right. So I wonder for some parents if it's just easier with the early dismissal to take their kids to work with them, or that's why you're not seeing as many kids today.
That's possible, or some of them. It was rather cold this morning, although it wasn't the wind chill warning level, but it was rather cold, so perhaps some of them decided to stay in out of the weather.
So I think this can be, I'm sure you're very much aware of all the social media conversation that goes on around school closings and the decision to close or not. So that's why I was curious to just ask what factors you have. What do you take into account when you're thinking about closing? Is there kind of hard and fast rules that you follow or guidelines for your district?
Well, there are guidelines that we follow for our district. Believe it or not, temperature is a much easier call, if you will, a much easier decision, simply because I'll always follow what the National Weather Service issues as a forecast. In their warning level wind chill, it is possible in this area to get to the 30 below without wind chill, but it's not probable. But when that wind chill hits that magic 30-degree mark, that seems to be when the National Weather Service issues their actual warning. They'll move from the advisory to the watch to the warning. So when that warning hits, I think that's the most important indicator when we will either dismiss early or cancel school because of temperature. Snowfall or ice is a little bit more tricky, simply because we have to understand that, what are the road conditions. Anytime we have snow forecast, it's a pretty good bet that I'm going to be out at 4:30 a.m. driving the roads to make sure that I can say firsthand, here's what the conditions are like. So snow is a little bit more tricky. Temperature tends to be a little bit more hard and fast.
And so for temperature, it sounds like it's not a specific number. Like you said, 30 below is a kind of a sign for you, but it's really more you're following the National Weather Service and the watches and warnings they're issuing.
Correct. It's approximately 25 to 30 below is what, not being a meteorologist, but paying close attention to it. That's usually what I see.
And the question is also not necessarily even if to make that decision, but also when to make that decision. For a situation like this week, how early do you try to make a decision like that?
As early as possible. For example, with our early dismissal, yesterday I sent that call out home to parents at probably about 5:30 in the afternoon. That's when I was able to determine that the National Weather Service had predicted that the warning level wind chills would hit at about 3 o'clock today. So I thought it was prudent to give about 90 minutes for kids to get home before it hit that level. So the notification for the parents the day before, the afternoon before, is certainly helpful. Being a parent myself, I understand that there's a lot of factors that go into that. So the sooner, the better.
And Superintendent Johnson, I wonder how you think this decision for you is different, whether, as you said, you don't have very many rural areas. I wonder when you're thinking about rural areas, if that might be a different decision for you?
It certainly would be. We're at the edge of Henry County, and Henry County is relatively flat, which in the Champaign area, you probably understand that the drifting is significant. So we'll have many of our rural school districts in the area that will be canceled, but since we're contained within the city limits of Kelowna, we're able to come, and it's just fine. So I think it's important for all listeners to understand that individual districts have to make individual decisions as they apply. We do not have a transportation department, so we have a fair amount of kids who are walking or riding their bikes to school, so that definitely plays into my decision-making process about how much the kids will be out in the weather. If we did have a transportation department, we'd have to contemplate how long are kids standing at the bus stop. So each individual district definitely has factors that they need to consider, superintendents need to consider when they're canceling school.
Superintendent Johnson, I remember when I was in Chicago during, I think, the last round of the polar vortex, which was a couple of years ago, there was a lot of grousing from people on sites like Facebook saying, hey, when I was an older person, I braved the cold temperatures and I was fine. Are there things you think that maybe people aren't thinking about that you think about as a school administrator when you're making this decision?
Well, it's a variety of things, Nyla. For example, today I stand in front of the school every morning and make sure traffic's moving appropriately. I have a pretty heavy coat on, and the number of students who are walking in today just with a hooded sweatshirt is slightly disturbing. Now, granted, they only have to walk from their parents' car to the doors of the school, but nonetheless, what is the preparedness level of the student to be able to be out in that? That's
so no coats, huh?
Coats are becoming a lost art. I like the joke. So definitely we have to worry about those students. I understand that there's a lot of working parents who are long gone by the time the student leaves for school, so there might not be that direct parental guidance on, okay, you need to bundle up, where's your gloves, where's your hat? So there's a number of factors to consider. I think I'm getting old enough now that I have the idealized memory as well about how much tougher I was when I was, 12 years old versus what I am now.
Well, that's Superintendent Carl Johnson with Kelowna School District in the Quad Cities. Superintendent, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I know you're pretty busy with all of your preparations today. I appreciate it.
Have a great day. Thank you for calling.
And whether we're talking about schools or to the transit system, by the way, many towns are offering warming buses at busy transit sites so people are not waiting outside in bus shelters. Lots of people are coping with this extreme weather. Governor Pritzker has put an emergency preparedness plan into place. Other organizations across Illinois are also taking precautions. Illinois' Emergency Management Agency has identified a list of warming centers across our state where people can take refuge from the outside. And if you're looking for more information on a warming center near you, we'll have a list on Twitter. Our handle's 21stshow, as well as at our website, 21stshow.org. One of those warming centers is Carpenter's Place in Rockford. Executive Director Kate Larrick is on the line with me now. Hi, Kate. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Also joining us is Matt Burgess with Home Sweet Home Ministries in Bloomington. Hi, Matt. Thanks for being here as well.
Thank you.
Kay, I wonder if you can just tell us a little bit, what is the warming center that you operate? What does it look like? Is it just a room where people can come in the day?
Do you want me to go first?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In the case of Carpenter's Place, this is something that we offer year-round as part of our services to homeless adults. We have what we call a day room. So our day room, it's a large space. It has probably about 30 or 40 small, like, four-top tables, you know, with chairs around them. And that's kind of the core of it. But there's a place also then to take showers. We offer breakfast, lunch, snacks. We try to have positive activities throughout the day, which might be art classes or somebody coming in talking about budgeting. We have chess, checkers, you know, books on word searches and things like that for people to do. And because it is offered on a daily basis, it's really become, you know, very like a social place for people to have positive interaction with others. So everybody is welcome during the days when we have this inclement weather. On the usual days, it's our population that we serve is homeless adults, both men and women. And that's kind of the entry into our other services, which are case management and housing and employment services and things like that. But that's kind of what it looks like, just a large cafe-type room.
And Matt, for you with Home Sweet Home Ministries in Bloomington, I know you all offer similar services. And I wonder how you prepare for something like this. You guys have used to doing this, I imagine. I don't think many of us are thinking, say, in the fall about how to plan ahead for something like this. But I imagine you are.
Yeah, I think all of us that are experienced with serving people who are homeless know that every winter in Illinois, it gets pretty cold. This is exceptionally cold right now, but so we think ahead as much as we can. While we're not a designated warming center, we do provide increased access for people to stay in our building during the day, in our dining center where people will be coming for meals. We kind of relax the standards of only being on site during those service times to be, you know, if you don't have someplace else warm to be, you can be here. In addition to that, we make sure that we have hats, gloves, scarves available at our front desk for people that might be coming in that we notice are coming in with their heads uncovered. And we say, hey, we've got hats before you head out. Do you want to take one with you so you can stay warm? Different things like that.
Kay, do you expect to be crowded over the next 48 hours or so?
You know, that's always a great question. Because certainly, you know, people need a place to be. What our experience has shown us, Carpenter's Place has been open for about 19 years now. And what our experience has shown us is that sometimes when the weather gets this severe, family and friends who may not otherwise welcome a family member or friend in who's, you know, homeless at the time, during these times, many of them do open their hearts and open their homes to others. So if somebody has that opportunity to stay with a friend or family member, they do so, and, you know, we're happy they do. And sadly, too, those who stay outside, they're very smart. And they learn that once they layer their clothes, and if they get into a place where they've layered, could be cardboard, newspaper, blankets, whatever, if they get into a situation where they're warm, they don't want to come out of that to come here. So those are a couple cases where actually numbers could go down Now, yesterday, the numbers were, it was about average. We have about, we see a little over 70 people a day, and it was about that yesterday. So we'll just see. But I know that we have many times been planning for extra people during these times, and that hasn't always been the case. But just like Matt said, we're very prepared and very, very grateful for the community preparing us this fall with wonderful supplies of all those winter items he mentioned, you know, boots, coats, hats, gloves, scarves, all the things to help them layer up and be as warm as possible when outside.
Matt, one last question for you then. I wonder, to Case Point, about the donations that you've gotten earlier in the year. What can people do if they are looking to lend a hand in this immediate weather, tonight or tomorrow? What would you suggest folks do?
You know, I think it's important that we're paying special attention during this particular cold snap to the needs of people right now. But it's always good to remember that those needs exist throughout the year, every year. And so to be looking for places to get involved, either through donating or volunteering or getting plugged in some other way, that's helpful. But especially right now during this cold snap, remembering that the people who are outside are still members of the community, who are our neighbors, even though they lack a fixed address. And so we should show concern for them, ask them if they're okay, if they need help getting to a warm place. Just those simple acts of compassion go a long way during crises like this.
That's Matt Burgess. He's the Chief Operating Officer of Home Sweet Home Ministries in Bloomington. I want to thank Kay Larrick for joining us as well. She's the Executive Director of Carpenter's Place in Rockford. Both of you, thanks for being with us. Thanks for taking the time. I know it's a very busy day for you guys.
Thank you.
Stay
warm.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to take a break. But after that, what does a life sentence mean if you're sent to prison as a teenager? The state Supreme Court is hearing a case today that asks this very question. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We'll start that conversation just after the break. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You've heard the term life in prison. Here in Illinois, it's something only adults can be sentenced to. But what does a life sentence mean if you're a teenager and you get 40 years? Is that a life sentence? What about 50? That's a question up before the Illinois Supreme Court. They're actually hearing this argument this week in the case of the People versus Buffer. Buffer is Dimitri Buffer, who was 16 years old when he got shot in when he shot into a car, thinking it belonged to a rival gang member. Instead, it killed a 25-year-old woman. His sentence schedules his release for when he's 66 years old. We're going to talk about this case with a reporter who's been covering this for Injustice Watch, as well as Vic Amar from the University of Illinois Law School. He's the dean and a constitutional law scholar in a few minutes. But first, joining us now is Dimitri Buffer's attorney, Assistant Appellate Defender Chris Gerke. Hi, Chris. Welcome to The 21st.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
So your client, Dimitri Buffer, is currently in prison now for shooting that woman. Her name was Jessica Bazan in 2009. Can you tell us about his sentence for that crime?
Yeah. So his sentence is 50 years. So at the time he was sentenced, the law in Illinois was that any juvenile offender who's 15 years or older, so 15, 16, 17, are treated exactly the same as adults for murder, for sentencing for murder. So that meant that his minimum possible sentence in this case was 45 years, of which he would have to serve every single day. And the judge ultimately gave him a 50-year sentence. And when the judge did so, and because of the high mandatory minimum, the judge didn't really give sufficient effect to his youth. And in fact, his sentence, came down before the U.S. Supreme Court, announced in Graham versus Florida and Miller versus Alabama that, these juveniles' youth is constitutionally significant at sentencing.
And then what changed with your appeal in 2017 then?
What changed with the appeal in 2017 was that the appellate court agreed with our argument that my client's sentence was functionally equivalent to a life sentence. So what the U.S. Supreme Court decided in Graham v. Florida and Miller v. Alabama was that you cannot give a sentence, a life sentence to a juvenile offender, particularly for murder, without giving sufficient consideration to their youth. But that's because the court recognized that, you know, juveniles' brains are different than adults. You know, they're more reckless, they're more impulsive, they are more vulnerable to outside pressures, and they're more capable of rehabilitation. And so these are things that, you know, courts have since have recognized since my client was sentenced originally that are constitutionally significant. And so what the appellate court did was decide that my client's sentence was functionally equivalent to a life sentence.
And I should correct something I said earlier. The state Supreme Court heard this case earlier this month. That's when you appeared there. What did you want the Illinois Supreme Court to understand about this particular case involving Dimitri Buffer?
I wanted the appellate court to understand that. So the two sides of the argument are that the U.S. Supreme Court, and particularly in Graham v. Florida, recognized that the problem with giving a juvenile offender, you know, a life sentence is that it deprives them of a meaningful opportunity to obtain release based on their maturity and rehabilitation. And so they recognize that they use words like, you know, a juvenile offender needs to be given a chance for fulfillment beyond prison walls and for reconciliation with society. If a juvenile is given a sentence where their youth is not considered at their sentencing hearing and their sentence doesn't, you know, give effect to their youth because it releases them either – it won't release them until they die or shortly before, you know, their life expectancy, then that doesn't really give effect to those considerations that the Supreme Court recognized in Graham and Miller. Now, the state's position was that, you know, it's okay under the Eighth Amendment to give a juvenile offender – you know, a sentence that lasts until their 70s, mid-70s, without ever considering their youth. You know, our position is that, and I think that it's more grounded in the Eighth Amendment in this case law, is that a sentence has to give a juvenile offender a meaningful opportunity for release, meaning a meaningful opportunity to actually rejoin society again and show that, you know, give effect to their rehabilitative potential they can't be denied that opportunity without first having their youth properly considered.
Mm. Okay, so it comes back to that consideration. And when we think about your client in particular, obviously it could take months for the court to come to a decision. I wonder how Dimitri Buffer is reacting to all of this now, what he's hoping for.
Well, I mean, he's obviously hoping for for us to win. If we win our case, then any juvenile offender who received a sentence of 50 years or higher, whose youth was not considered, which is likely for any juvenile offender who faced, you know, an extremely high mandatory minimum like that my client did, they'll get a new sentencing hearing. To be clear, that the purpose of this, the goal of this argument isn't necessarily that, you know, juvenile offenders, you know, can't, you know, receive, you know, be held responsible for their crimes, but the issue is that they need to have a proportionate sentence that takes their youth, you know, into account. So at the time my client was sentenced, as I said, his minimum sentence was 45 years. Illinois and other states have since Miller and Graham, these U.S. Supreme Court cases came down, they've recognized that's an inappropriately long sentence for a juvenile offender, and they've changed the law. So instead of 45 years for murder, which included a mandatory 25-year firearm add-on, now the minimum sentence for murder is just 20 years, and the judge is required to consider these mitigating factors of youth when imposing a sentence. So all my client is hoping for is just to have that shot to prove that, you know, this offense was, you know, a product of, you know, his youth, his inexperience, you know, his recklessness and impulsivity, and that he's rehabilitated and he has a chance for rehabilitation and deserves to be let out of prison, you know, before he's reaching nearly 70 years old.
That's Chris Gerke with the Office of the State Appellate Defender. Chris, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks again for having me.
Emily Horner is on the line with us now from Chicago, where she's a reporter with Injustice Watch, and she's been covering this issue. In studio with me in Urbana is Vikram Amar, who's dean of the University of Illinois College of Law and a constitutional law scholar. Both of you, thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Emily, as we just heard, obviously it makes sense that this young man, Dimitri Buffer, is anxious for a verdict. But to Chris's point about that this would allow for perhaps new sentencing hearings for others, How many other, there are a number of other juvenile offenders in Illinois prisons who are also in this situation serving sentences of 50 years or more?
Yeah, so reporting that we've done here at Injustice Watch, we looked through, you know, the Illinois prison system and found at least 167 other offenders who were, you know, arrested as before they turned 18 and who are sentenced to serve, you know, at least 50 years or more. That includes people who also have discretionary, you know, life sentences. I recently took a look at how many people have the exact same sentence as Mr. Buffer, and there are 32 people currently serving, you know, or set to serve at least 50 years in Illinois prisons.
And Vic, Amar, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more of the background of that U.S. Supreme Court case. I believe this was 2017. That's when it became unconstitutional.
Actually, it was 2012.
2012.
So the, Mr. Gerke referred to two cases, and they're both important, the one from Florida. But I think in some ways Miller versus Alabama from 2012 is a key precedent. And that held that you can't have a mandatory life sentence for a juvenile who's tried as an adult that doesn't allow for the juvenile's youth to be taken into consideration. Doesn't mean that a juvenile can never be sentenced to life or for a very long term.
It just meant it could be automatic.
Can't be automatic. So one question in this State versus Buffer case is, was this really automatic? Because he was actually actually sentenced under two separate provisions. One that said you get automatically 25 years for using a gun, and you get a minimum of 20 years for committing the murder. So I think because those were both part of the same homicide, it really does make sense to think of them as a single sentence for a single crime.
And so it wouldn't have to be consecutive, in other words, like, or they wouldn't be stacked.
Well,
up against
let's each say other. He was someone was convicted of both rape and murder, which are kind of separate offenses, even though they're part of the same criminal episode. And let's say the mandatory minimum for both of them was 25 years. So the total would be 50 years. And the statute says that you run these concurrently, not consecutively, not concurrently. I'm not sure that would be viewed as an automatic or mandatory 50-year sentence. It would be viewed as a two separate mandatory 25-year sentence. But on the facts of this case, I do think it makes sense to think of this as a 45-year minimum. He was sentenced to 50, which is more than the judge had to, but the judge had to sentence him to at least 45. So the question presented is 45 cruel and unusual for a juvenile?
For a 16-year-old.
The same way that a life sentence was in Alabama versus Miller.
Mm-hmm. And Emily, I wonder as we're thinking about this, I wonder how this compares to laws in other states. How does Illinois compare?
So what I've heard from talking with people across the country is that this is very much an issue that is still percolating. There are lots of states that have passed laws in recent years that are, you know, creating earlier opportunities for young people with very long sentences to ask for parole. You know, and here in Illinois, even though it hasn't been signed by the governor, late last year, the Illinois legislature passed through a bill that would provide young people convicted who are under the age of 21 to get, you know, incremental chances to ask for parole. And that law is not retroactive, so it wouldn't apply to Mr. Buffer. But certainly this is, you know, an issue that courts across the country are still kind of trying to figure out and determine how long are too long of sentences for juvenile offenders and kind of what reaches that level of a life sentence.
So Vic Amar is with us, and I wonder if you can just speak to a little bit of, I was reading earlier this morning, Justice Kagan wrote for the majority decision talking about the difference when we are talking about youth and juveniles in particular.
So that was in the Graham case from Florida. And again, as Mr. Gerke pointed out, the basic idea is that treating juveniles the same as adults, even when you try them as adults, when it comes to sentencing, may not give adequate weight to the differences between youth. Young people are more prone to make rash mistakes. They may be more susceptible to rehabilitation. That at least a
and
judge
that's the, has, actually that's the that's actually brain chemistry. I mean, we know that from the science
sure.
of it.
That's
okay.
right. As well as just you know how hardened somebody is. Someone is just not as hardened at 16 as they might be at 30. But to pull the lens back a little bit, you know, you've got this Eighth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that says we're not supposed to impose cruel or unusual punishments. So the word unusual itself requires that we do some kind of comparison to what's going on in a particular state to what's going on elsewhere, which is why you asked the question of what other states are doing. So, you know, it's a hard question sometimes to answer, even if we're just looking at the other states. Because, for example, some other states might have mandatory minimums like this for people who are convicted, but they may be less inclined to try juveniles as adults in the first place. So you have far fewer juveniles who are shunted into the adult system. So how do you count them? Are they states that are more lenient, or are they states that are more harsh because the juveniles that do get sentenced get longer sentences?
And do we look at how other countries handle this, other Western countries,
so
like more
that's
developed?
One of a number of questions. So some justices on the court would look to other Western democracies. Others, like the departed Justice Scalia, would say, no, this is a distinctive U.S. constitutional norm, and we should look only at other states. Even when we look at the other states, though, should the size of the states matter? Should Wyoming count as much as California, even though it's, you know, 1/100th the size? Should we look at how lopsided the recent statutes that move in the direction of leniency are? I mean, if there's an overwhelming consensus in a lot of states that have acted, should we count that? Should we count recent developments more than ones that were 20 years ago? Should the trend line matter? Should the momentum matter? Should we look at poll data that hasn't yet been reflected in actual legislative enactments? These are all contested questions. Now, notice that the replacement of Justice Gorsuch for Justice Scalia probably won't change the calculus on the court. But Justice Kennedy is in the majority in these cases that rule in favor of the juvenile defendants. And who knows how Brett Kavanaugh is going to feel about the Eighth Amendment in this setting. In the D.C. Circuit, he didn't have to deal with that nearly as much. And just to say something on behalf of the state of Illinois for a moment, you know, the reason why, even though the Eighth Amendment requires judges to do some kind of a comparative assessment, judges don't want to be displacing the will of majorities and legislatures willy-nilly. And once the court says something is unconstitutionally cruel and unusual, that's a one-way ratchet. That's a lock-in. Then even if people change their minds in states going forward, there's nothing they can do about it because it's now illegal.
It's a big decision, in other words. And you, just a reminder to our audience, you were talking about the federal Supreme Court implications. This case is being heard in the Illinois State Supreme Court.
But Emily, if the state loses, it can appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Good point. Emily, when you spoke to different advocates and legal experts, I wonder what they're saying about the particular significance of this case regarding Dmitri Buffer.
Yeah, so the experts that I spoke with said that, you know, the ruling in this case could go a number of ways and could potentially mean a number of different things. The question before the court right now is, you know, is the law unconstitutional as it was applied to Dmitri Buffer's case individually? So, you know, they're looking at just this one case, just these particular facts. And so, you know, a decision, let's say the court decides that the 50-year sentence amounts to a life term, that would lead to, you know, the potential for other offenders with similar sentences to kind of posture themselves in line with, you know, Buffer's circumstances and then seek, you know, resentencing or whatever that way.
For the 30 or so other cases you were talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or the even the, you know, 167 people who are serving, you know, even longer sentences. total. So there's also the opportunity that the Illinois Supreme Court could, you know, say something about the 50-year sentence in general and not link it to Mr. Buffer's case, and that could, you know, be used to apply to a bunch of other people.
Right. So I'm afraid we're out of time, so I'm going to have to stop you there. Sorry to interrupt, but we will be keeping, I know you'll be keeping an eye on this case, and we will as well. That's Emily Horner with Injustice Watch, and I want to thank Vic Amar, Dean of U of I's College of Law, Constitutional Law Scholar. Both of you, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Two Central Illinois men have pleaded guilty in federal court in Minnesota to bombing the Dar el-Farouk Islamic Center in Bloomington, Minnesota in August of 2017. Michael McWhorter and Joe Morris were two of the three Clarence, Illinois men accused of bombing the mosque. The third man, Michael Harry, is also charged, but he's still in jail, actually here in Illinois, facing additional charges. Joining us from St. Paul, we have Matt Sepik. He's a reporter with Minnesota Public Radio who's been following the case and is here to give us an update. Matt, welcome back to The 21st.
Well, it's good to be back, Nyla.
What did we learn last week in court about Michael McWhorter and Joe Morris? What did they confirm in the courtroom about what happened back in August of 2017?
They didn't just plead guilty to the five felony charges against them. During separate hour-long change of plea hearings, they agreed point by point with Judge Donovan Frank as he laid out the facts underlying those charges. As that relates to the mosque bombing in Bloomington, Minnesota, McWhorter and Morris admitted traveling in a rental truck with alleged ringleader Michael Harry from their hometown of Clarence, just north of Champaign-Urbana, to Bloomington, Minnesota. They covered their tracks. The men left their phones behind and steered clear of the Illinois tollway to avoid its license plate readers. And when they got to Minnesota, they said Harry told them why they were there, and it was to bomb the Dar el-Farouk Islamic Center in the Minneapolis suburb of Bloomington. Before they got to the mosque, they filled a plastic container with gas and diesel fuel. Morris admitted breaking the window of the mosque and tossing in the fuel container. McWhorter lit the fuse on the bomb and threw it in. Fortunately, no one was hurt when the bomb exploded. This was around 5 a.m. on August 5th of 2017. But there were five people inside that mosque for early morning prayers. Muhammad Omar, the center's executive director, was in the room adjacent to the imam's office, which bore the brunt of the damage from the blast.
So how many years do we think these two gentlemen are facing?
The Minnesota charges alone, that carries a mandatory minimum sentence of 30 years. The other three charges from Illinois that I mentioned have a five-year mandatory minimum. I should add that another man, 19-year-old Ellis Mack, he pleaded guilty to militia-related charges in Urbana. This is not in connection with the mosque bombing. He's due to be sentenced in April.
So that militia, that's the White Rabbit Militia. Can you remind us about that group?
This was allegedly founded around the time of the mosque bombing in August of 2017 by 47-year-old Michael Harry. And according to the indictments and the guilty pleas for Morris and McWhorter, these guys wreaked all sorts of havoc, mainly across Illinois. They robbed Walmart stores in Watsika and Mount Vernon. Around the same time, they pretended to be police and tried to rob a suspected drug trafficker in Ambia, Indiana. They also tried to extort close to $200,000 from the Canadian National Railway by bombing tracks near Effingham. And prosecutors also alleged that they threw a pipe bomb into a women's clinic in Champaign in November of 2017. That bomb did not go off, but that was the basis for the attempted arson charges that Morris and McWhorter pleaded guilty to on Thursday. There's really more to this. I could really keep going.
I mean, it doesn't sound like it's real, Matt. Whenever you'd say the details of this, it's like a movie, but these are actually things that are...
And it's not. It is deadly serious, and people could have really gotten hurt with what these men admitted doing now. We can say that because two have pleaded guilty.
I wanted to just play some audio that you had gathered, Matt. It's of Joe Morris's defense attorney, Robert Richman, speaking to reporters after the hearing. He said he plans to argue that Joe Morris should get less than the minimum because of influence by the, quote, ringleader Michael Harry.
Mr. Harry made important decisions about Joe Morris's upbringing, where he should go to school, where he should live. And so in 2017, when Michael Hari began this outrageous escapade, Joe Morris did not have the wherewithal to tell him no.
Thanks to Minnesota Public Radio for that audio. Matt Sepik, who gathered that, is with us. Matt, what is next for Michael Hari?
He's planning to go to trial on the federal charges in Illinois. That is set for July. There are two separate federal indictments, one from Minneapolis, one from Urbana. The Illinois part of the case needs to be resolved before Hari can answer for the mosque bombing in Bloomington, Minnesota. So it appears for the time being, Hari will remain in Illinois.
Matt, I know during the course of your reporting, you've also been looking at how the bombing has affected the Muslim community in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. And I wanted to just play some audio of Jelani Hussein from the Council on American-Islamic Relations after the plea hearings last Thursday.
They wanted to attack the Muslim community. They wanted for the Muslim community to fear, and they wanted the Muslim community to run away. We're not going anywhere. We are more resilient than ever.
Again, that's Jelani Hussein of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Matt Sepik, I think oftentimes when there are incidents like this, it can be traumatic on multiple levels, not just when it happens, but when there's a trial. What are you hearing from the not just the Islamic community in Bloomington, Minnesota now, but also just other people in the community and how they've been supporting their Muslim neighbors during this time?
Well, earlier, Nyla, I mentioned that Mohammed Omar, the executive director of the Dar al-Farouk Islamic Center, was in the room immediately adjacent to the imam's office where that bomb went off. And he, along with the four others who were in the building at the time, wasn't hurt. And he'd been attending some of the hearings for McWhorter and Morris. But Jelani Hussein, who we just heard from in that clip, I asked him after the news conference on Thursday, well, where's Mohammed Omar? He's not here today. Hussein told me Omar just didn't want to come for the plea hearings because it was just too painful to hear the judge read through the details of the crime and the attack. Omar just didn't want to relive that trauma. And he had told me a couple of months ago that he went through the civil war in Somalia, but his only brush with death was here in Minnesota at his own mosque in suburban Minneapolis.
Mm. Matt Sepik is a reporter with Minnesota Public Radio, has been covering all of this. Thanks for being with us, Matt. I appreciate the update. I wonder if you've been fighting off one giant cold this winter. I know lots of people in our office feel that way. When you do, it's tempting to call your doctor and ask for an antibiotic. But a new study points out that more than 80% of antibiotic prescriptions in the U.S. are not appropriate, which means you could still feel lousy and be left with a slew of unwanted side effects. And the effect overall? The broader costs, according to the CDC, at least 2 million people get an antibiotic-resistant infection every year, and at least 23,000 people die from that. Dr. Jeffrey Linder is one of the co-authors of this study about antibiotic prescription use. He's the chief of general internal medicine and geriatrics. He also teaches at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Dr. Linder, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I wonder if we can just start by you reminding us exactly what antibiotics are and when they're helpful.
Antibiotics, as commonly referred, are drugs that kill bacteria. So there's something about them that impairs bacterial machinery. And so the idea is that they will stop bacteria from growing but won't affect our own cells. And the key distinction that people should understand is the difference between a viral infection. So viruses are very small infectious germs that actually don't respond to antibiotics, and bacteria for which antibiotics are effective.
Mm-hmm. And so when we say that antibiotics are common, it says that according to the study, just 13% of outpatient antibiotic prescriptions were appropriate.
Right.
36 were considered potentially appropriate. What does that mean? Is that essentially then they were prescribed to fight bacteria and not a virus?
It seems like it. And so your listeners would be forgiven for thinking, you know, haven't we heard this story about inappropriate prescribing before? And we can go over what this particular study adds, one thing is that we went through all of the diagnostic criteria that doctors use when patients are seeing their doctor, and we classified them as always appropriate for an antibiotic, sometimes, and never. And so when we looked at all the antibiotic prescriptions, we found that only 13% of them were associated with a diagnosis code that was always appropriately associated with an antibiotic, and 36% potentially appropriate for an antibiotic. So things like that most readily would come to mind for your listeners are probably a sinus infection or pharyngitis or a sore throat, where for those, actually, most people and most adults in particular with sore throats and sinus infections don't need to be treated with antibiotics, but that's one of these diagnoses that's potentially appropriate.
And so this, I think, also comes down to a culture issue between doctor and patients, right? And I wonder how often it is a conversation or a level of trust or understanding you have to have with your doctor if they say you don't need a prescription.
Yeah, I think you do have to have a level of trust. And I would actually turn the blame around back on us, we the doctors, in that the mistake we make very often is to assume that the patient wants an antibiotic. And are worried that either explaining why an antibiotic is not going to be necessary is going to make the patient angry, it's going to take a long time, or they're going to be dissatisfied. And so because of that fear, what's going on in the doctor's mind, doctors frequently prescribe antibiotics inappropriately.
So that leads us to another Northwestern study about the benefits of seeing a primary care doctor. And I just wanted to ask you about that, because one of the findings was that patients who had regular contacts with one primary doctor were slightly more likely to get unnecessary antibiotics. So I wonder what you if you have a sense of why you think that link exists.
Yeah. So this study that just came out yesterday, we were trying to measure hopefully the benefits, or describe the benefits of having primary care. And indeed, having a primary care doctor was associated with getting a lot more high-value care, so preventive services and the like. But we also found that having a primary care doctor was more often associated with getting inappropriate antibiotics, so a little bit more low-value care. And I think this is probably just because people who have primary care doctors have a little bit easier access to the medical system and might call their primary care doctor with a symptom that probably shouldn't be treated with an antibiotic, like I was mentioning a second ago, sinus symptoms, a sore throat, a cough, and their primary care doctor is more readily able to prescribe an antibiotic as compared to a person who doesn't have a primary care doctor. So I think that's why we're seeing this potential harm of having easier access to primary care.
And this is actually one of the first studies to compare the quality and experience of outpatient care for patients with a primary care doctor to those who don't. And I wonder what you think, as we think about that, how we should think about our relationship with primary care doctors versus specialists, which I think sometimes people think, well, you should just go see a specialist because they're the expert.
Yeah, and I would compare – it's helpful to think about the healthcare system in the U.S. compared to other countries. So a lot of other countries spend somewhere around 20% of their healthcare money on primary care. In the United States, we only spend about 6 or 7% of our healthcare dollar on primary care. The four components of primary care, we kind of refer to the four Cs. So first contact, comprehensive, continuous, and coordinated care – that your primary care doctor should be able to take care of most things you need done. And, we focus on prevention, wellness, and so forth, so that you might not even need to see a specialist if we can kind of either prevent things from happening or nip things in the bud. And I think on a population level, we'd probably do better as a country to invest a little bit more heavily in primary care. And this new study document some of those benefits of having better funded and more accessible primary care.
And it sounds like we need to change our mindset in this country about that as well.
I think that's right. You should expect your primary care doctor should be able to take care of about 80 to 90% of every problem you have. And the idea of running off to specialty care can kind of create problems. You know, specialists are great. If I have cancer, I'm going to go see a cancer doctor. If I have a heart attack, I want to see a heart doctor. But for the vast majority of problems people have, and for prevention, having a relationship with a primary care doctor can, in some cases, stave off the need for having for needing to see a specialist anyway.
Dr. Jeffrey Linder is Chief of General Internal Medicine and Geriatrics. He also teaches at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Dr. Linder, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That does it for us today. Just a reminder to keep an eye, stay tuned to this local NPR station throughout the day for more information about this weather. And it's a good time to remember, as some of us pointed out earlier, to look out for your neighbors. Weather this cold can be isolating, and maybe you can think of a reminder to think about people you know who might need a call or check in to see if they're doing okay. You stay warm. I will see you back here tomorrow. Our website, 21stshow.org, is always a good place to go for resources, more information about us, everything we talked about on the show today. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. We are a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.